TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Rupert Reed, this civilization is finished. So what is to be done? Dr. Rupert Reed is teaching philosophy at the University of East Anglia. He's a longtime Green Party politician. In October 2018, Reed declared himself a supporter of Extinction Rebellion, an environmental direct action group, and he became a signatory of the open letters published in The Guardian. Vandana Shiva, Naomi Klein, Noam Chomsky, Bill McKibben, and many more also signed on to that letter. Rupert Reed was also one of over 200 academics to sign an open letter of support for the school strike for climate, a movement where children walk out of schools to demand action on climate change. This radio program is based on Rupert Reed's very popular talk, This Civilization is Finished, So What is to be Done?, filmed at Churchill College, University of Cambridge, UK, on November 7, 2018. Here is Rupert Reed.
So I want to start out by addressing the younger people in the room, which is the majority of you younger than me. And what I want to say to you is slightly stark, is this, that your leaders have failed you. Your governments have failed you. Your parents and their generation have failed you. Your teachers have failed you. And I failed you. And what I mean by that is that we have all failed to warn adequately and to prevent the dangerous climate change that is now here and that is coming and that is definitely going to get a lot worse. Definitely. And because of that failure, I'm afraid for you. I have fear for you. I fear that some of you are unlikely to grow old. And there is nothing really worse for human beings than not being able to take adequate care of the next generation. I'm really sorry to have to be the one to say this to you, though I suspect that many of you already know that something like this is true, and I'll come back to that point. So why do I say this? Why do I come with such a negative message? Well, let's talk about the Paris Agreement, because that's what is supposed to be giving us all hope around dangerous climate change, yeah? And it was a remarkable achievement. It was hard to expect anything better than Paris. Every country in the world had to agree. And incredibly, they did. And they came up with reasonably bold proposals for reining in climate-dangerous emissions. So let's talk about why that extraordinary achievement, very hard to see how one could have hoped for more than Paris, was absolutely not enough. So the first thing to say about Paris is that, of course, Paris was now a few years ago, and things have got quite a bit worse since then. The world's weather systems appear to be spinning out of control, just in the last 3 years, basically, since around the time of Paris. Other bad things that have happened since then, well, the most recent was, you may have heard, that there is new scientific evidence about the extent to which heat has been stored in the oceans, a lot more than was previously recognized. And that's a kind of ticking time bomb part of the global overheating problem, which is not going to go away. So things have got worse since Paris, and meanwhile, the initial signs of compliance with Paris are not good. I'll come back to that point. Next problem with Paris, of course, is that, as we all know, the most powerful man in the world from what is, in practice, really still the most polluting nation in the world, the United States. They say that China is, but of course that's false, really. It only looks like China is because you ascribe all the emissions to China for all the products that China exports to us and to the Americans and so on. The most powerful man in the world, the most powerful country in the world, has pulled out of the Paris Agreement, which is a pretty devastating hammer blow against Paris. But it's much worse than that. If we talk about the 2-degree target for Paris, I'll come to 1.5 degrees a bit later in my talk. 1.5 degrees is unbelievably optimistic to think that we could possibly manage that. I'll come back to that. If we talk about the 2-degree target in Paris, well, most scientists agree that actually, if all of the commitments that are supposed to be made in order for the Paris Treaty to work were made, the actual dangerous climate change that would result would raise global temperatures by quite a lot more than 2 degrees. It would probably be 2.7, 3, 3.4, something like that. In other words, the science on which the Paris Agreement is based is itself overly conservative, overly optimistic. And that's not too surprising when you consider that the IPCC is actually not a properly scientific process. It's a scientific process that has built into it also a political process. But it's worse than that, because actually the commitments that countries have made towards those Paris targets are well short of what would be required in order to meet those targets. Right? Countries voluntarily commit under Paris to say, what are they going to do to meet their Paris obligations? And if you add all those up, and people have added them all up, they come to considerably less than what Paris requires in order to work. But it's worse than that. You see, there's a pattern emerging here. Because actually, the commitments that countries have made, the commitments that governments have made to reach those Paris targets, are actually in stark contradiction to what virtually every single one of those governments, with possibly the exception of Bhutan, are planning to do over the next 10 years or so. So virtually every country in the world has plans to encourage further economic growth, has plans to encourage simply to build a lot more infrastructure, transport infrastructure, industrial infrastructure, etc. Most of those plans, not all, but most of those plans stand in opposition to the possibility of achieving those Paris commitments. And will you tell me which one is likely to win out, right? Classic dilemma. If you have the business ministry against the environment ministry, or the chancellor against the climate change minister, well, which one wins? I'll leave it to you to guess. But it's worse than that, because the IPCC, the worst thing arguably about the IPCC process is that it seriously underestimates the possibility of feedbacks which could spiral the climate system out of control, and which may already be kicking in, potentially explaining the disastrous weather chaos of the last few years. Among those feedbacks are the albedo loss feedback. So that's the loss of ice, for instance, in the Arctic. And you know, the less ice you have, the less heat and light gets reflected, the more gets absorbed. And there are scientists who suspect that the albedo loss situation is a lot worse than the IPCC have taken into account. And most scarily of all is the situation vis-a-vis methane, which we know now is starting to be released in significant quantities, again, mostly from the Arctic, from the permafrost, etc. And, well, they call it the methane dragon, those who are in the know about this. And they call it the methane dragon for a reason. I mean, dragons are a sort of icon of something kind of terrifying, overwhelming, out of control. If that methane release starts to accelerate, which might already be happening, and may well happen in a big way over the next 5, 10, 15 years, well, that locks us into catastrophic climate change, probably runaway climate change, because you then start getting a further vicious circle of more ice being melted, more methane being released, etc. And the crucial thing to remember about methane is that methane is a greenhouse gas approximately 25 times as powerful as carbon dioxide. And the final thing to know about the Paris Agreement is that the Paris Agreement, for its targets later this century to be achieved, depends on climate engineering technologies, geoengineering technologies, the idea being that you can engineer the climate of the entire Earth. There are only two problems with this dependence of the Paris Agreement on those technologies. They are firstly that the technologies do not exist. And I mean that pretty much literally. Most of them are simply fantasies that scientists, technologists, and engineers have. The ones that do exist have not been tried at scale, and we don't know that they'll work at scale if they were tried at scale. And the second problem is that even if they do exist or did exist, it would in most cases be profoundly reckless, radically unprecautious to put them into action, to bring them in at scale. It would be an experiment with the entire globe, with enormous deleterious possible and actual side effects. The one which they talk about the most, BECCS, which is basically growing lots of biomass that you then burn. You allegedly sequester the carbon. You allegedly keep the carbon safe for hundreds of years under the surface of the Earth. If that process works, which there's serious reason to doubt that you can do all of those things at scale, if you did it at scale, it would be devastating to the Earth's ecosystems. You would be basically creating huge amounts of monoculture and replacing the biodiverse ecosystems which need restoring rather than replacing. So geoengineering is built into virtually all the Paris scenarios. We've got no reason to believe it works. And if it does work, it probably still shouldn't be used. And I'll come back to exactly why it shouldn't be used in a bit more detail later in my talk. The conclusion, it seems to me, one is bound to draw from this, and look, I would love to be wrong, so please correct me if I can be corrected, but I've given this talk a number of times and I haven't heard any corrections yet. The conclusion I think one has to draw from this is that, well, to put it in a slightly crude, sort of modern way, Paris is toast. We know, if we're prepared to actually look at the facts, that the aims of the Paris Agreement will not be achieved, and they'll almost certainly be missed by a long way. That means that dangerous climate change is coming, and it is going to get a lot worse for a long time to come. Well, that's a key part of the context in which I say that we failed you. It seems to me there's only one possibility, and I'll come back to this in a second, there's only one possibility for how what I've just said could prove to be wrong, which is if people came to realise the kind of points that I've just been making and that a few others are starting to make, and came to realise just how desperate the situation was, then they might decide to do something completely unprecedented to change it. But it would have to be completely unprecedented. You get a sense of the scale of what I'm talking about. We're talking about turning around the entire supertanker of the world's economy, the entire supertanker of the world's civilization. It seems to me, in fact, that there are three possibilities before us in this context. Possibility number one is that we do what I just described. We transform civilization, a transformed civilization. We absolutely radically alter the entire basis of pretty much everything that we do. The kind of transformation we're talking about is a lot bigger than, for example, just a large-scale conversion to renewable energy. We would also have to be talking about radically reducing the amount of transportation of goods and people around the world, radically relocalizing, radically changing our farming practices and the entire nature of our agriculture, radically reducing the amount, obviously, of meat that we eat in countries like this, etc. It would be a total transformation, the likes of which we have never known, certainly not since history began. Well, look, I hope that happens, and probably like many of you, I'm working to make it happen. But what I want to put to you this evening, among other things, is the thought that it would be a bold person who was prepared to commit to the thought that that is going to happen, that we're going to make it happen, that we're going to make it happen quickly enough. It would be a very risky bet to bet everything upon that kind of completely unprecedented transformation and overcoming all the vast vested interests and ignorances and stupidities and so on and so forth which stand in the way of it. So that is why I think we have to consider further possibilities. So, possibility number two, a successor civilization after some kind of collapse. And that, it seems to me now, is what we have to start to think is very likely to happen, or put it this way, actually, very likely to be the best scenario we can realistically hope for, or plan towards. If the sketch that I gave you about Paris is right, then we are facing a burden, almost certainly, unless we are incredibly lucky or incredibly determined and brilliant, we are facing almost certainly changes around the world which are going to bring an end to this civilization with extreme prejudice. And so we need to think about what comes after it, considering the possibility seriously that that is what will happen, that this civilization will collapse. The third possibility, of course, is simply total collapse. There are various different forms that it could take. When I talk about total collapse, that could mean simply there is no more civilization, but there are a few people hanging on here and there. Lovelock talks about a few thousand breeding pairs in the Antarctic. Or it could be worse than that. It could mean complete human extinction and extinction of most other mammalian life on Earth. Or it could be worse than that. It could be the elimination of virtually all complex life. James Hansen talks about the possibility of the same kind of thing happening on Earth as happened on Venus. You may be aware that Venus's atmosphere is made up quite largely of carbon dioxide from extreme greenhouse effect. That's why Venus is a lot hotter than Mercury, even though Venus is a lot further from the sun than Mercury. The extreme possibility, and it is possible, is that the oceans would start to boil off on Earth, and that would be the end of all complex life, possibly even of all life. Now, I'm not going to talk much more about that. I think it's obvious that total collapse has to be avoided, and it doesn't hugely matter when you drill down within it which version of it you have, although it still does matter a bit. I'm more interested in talking about this, a successor civilization after collapse. Because it seems to me that what we've actually done, mostly up to this point, is assume that we can transform our civilization, or actually, more properly, what we've mostly done is assume that we can just kind of tinker with it and reform it, and that that will be enough. The most we've tended to assume is that we need a civilizational transformation. I'm suggesting that's the least that we need to aim at, but that it's not enough to just aim at it. We have to take seriously the possibility that given how bad things are, given how much we've let them go, that this is now going to be very hard to attain. And that something like this may be the best we can hope for. Any which way you look at these three possibilities, they justify my title, the title of my talk. This civilization is finished. Because the best outcome that could happen is that we transform this civilization out of all recognition. It will not look the same at all. It will be a transformation more radical than the change between the era of the 16th, 17th century and the Industrial Revolution. It will be more radical even than the Agricultural Revolution, I would suggest. It will be a total transformation. This civilization, business as we know it, is finished. It has a sell-by date on it. We just don't know how far past that sell-by date we're going to be able to keep the balls in the air. This civilization is finished. The question now is what comes after it. Is it going to be a transformed civilization? Is it going to be some kind of successor civilization? Or is it going to be nothing at all? Okay, so what is to be done? The second half of my title. If I'm right, what is to be done? And I've got a series of ideas on that I want to share with you. Another list. Number one, wake up. We need to wake up. We need to wake up to this reality. The think tank that I chair is called Greenhouse, and our previous project was called the Post-Growth Project, talking about why we had to give up the fetish for growth. Our new project is called the Facing Up to Climate Reality Project. And it does, I hope, what it says on the tin. What we think is that people need to face up to these very harsh realities that I'm sketching for you here and not pretend any longer that we can get away with just focusing on, say, you know, changing our energy infrastructure to renewable energy, or even get away with assuming that we can and will succeed in transforming our civilization in the way that I very much hope we still might. This waking up process is not necessarily particularly pleasant or easy. It may involve you, for example, if you're willing to go through it, experiencing some despair. It certainly should involve you experiencing some fear and some, well, a lot of sadness. If you're not sad about what's happening, if you're not afraid in the context of the kind of thing I'm saying, then you're not paying attention. And in fact, we can go further than that, I think. There's a wonderful new branch of psychology called eco-psychology. And what the eco-psychologists argue is that the despair, the fear, the sadness, the rage that we feel in this kind of context is rational and could even be described as a kind of consciousness arising from the earth itself, in the sense that we are feeling what we are doing to our beautiful planetary home. And those kind of feelings are appropriate. If you're not, as I say, if you're not feeling some of those feelings, if you're not feeling some of them right now, well, then one suspects there might be something wrong with you. So what the eco-psychologists say is, you know, don't as conventional psychology does, focus on the individual and say, well, this individual is feeling sad, they need to be fixed, right? Look at that individual and say, this individual is feeling sad. Ooh, that tells us something reliable. That is an expression of something reliable in relation to what's actually happening at this point in history and what's happening to the earth. So if you're experiencing bad feelings around this, well, then you're not alone, and you may be more rational than the people who are not experiencing those bad feelings. I'll also just briefly mention in passing that if you're experiencing them in a really, really bad way, well, then you should actively seek support from someone who can actually give it. For example, an eco-psychologist, or come and talk to me and I can potentially put you in touch with the growing number of therapists and psychiatrists who are actually seriously interested in helping people who are suffering from what we're doing to the earth and from the likely consequences in our lifetimes of that. And I'm just going to mention one person who's also very worth reading in this connection, who is the deep ecologist Joanna Macy. For example, her book, The Work That Reconnects, and that book is sort of like a guide for the person who is involved in this kind of difficult journey. She used to call the work that she does along these lines despair work, which I think is quite a useful phrase for it. So, firstly, let's wake up. Let's wake everyone else up too. It's not just us in this room. Secondly, we need to talk about this, and that's why it's really important that we're going to have a question and answer. It's really unhealthy to keep all this in the confines of your own mind. Let me tell you a very quick story about how the Greenhouse Facing Up to Climate Reality project started. We decided we needed to have a conversation among ourselves in the core team at Greenhouse of what was happening in relation to climate, was it enough, etc. And we started off with Go Round. And what we had to say in the Go Round was, what do you think is going to happen and what are your feelings about it? And if I remember rightly, I was the first person to go, and I said something like, well, what I think is going to happen is that very probably there is going to be a collapse. And what are my feelings about it? I'm terrified for myself, let alone for people who are younger than me. And I feel very lonely in it. I feel very alone in it because I think that no one else is really thinking this. And the next person went, and they said pretty much the same. And then the next person said pretty much the same. And of course, what was interesting about that was that by the time we'd gone around, two things had emerged. Firstly, that the feeling that some of us had had, certainly that I had had, that maybe I could sort of hold on to some hope that maybe I was wrong because maybe it was only me who was thinking this. Well, that was gone, right? No, it turned out that everyone else had been secretly thinking it as well. But then the second thing was more encouraging and more liberating, which was, so actually we can talk about it. It's not just me. We can talk about it in a group, and perhaps if we're having this conversation, starting to realize that we've all really got this fear, perhaps there's lots of other people out there who have it too, which is why I decided to start giving these kind of talks. Thirdly, we need to think about my option number two, the successor civilization idea. We need to think civilizational succession. We need to think about what that actually means. So what it means is very, very challenging. We need to think, for example, about how, if there's going to be some kind of partial collapse, at least, we preserve the values of civilization through that. Very, very difficult. A role, it seems to me, here for writers, for academics of all kinds, certainly for philosophers like myself. I think very little of this work has been done seriously yet, but I think this kind of building of a new kind of imaginary which can cope with the kind of scenarios I'm talking about, well, it's hard to think of intellectual work that could be more important at this time. Fourthly, following on from that point, we need, as I describe it, to build lifeboats through the storms that are coming. What kind of things do I mean by that? Well, I mean a whole load of things, and I can only sketch a few examples of them here. So we could start out with a little bit of individual prepping, preparing for potential collapse. So I would recommend to you, for example, to not keep all your money in the bank, but to keep some under your mattress, because it may well be that the banking system, the financial system, is not with us for very much longer. I'd recommend you to store some food, as I'm doing. By the way, I have got the money, but it's not, for anyone watching online, it's not actually under my mattress, so don't go looking there. You'd have to, like, tear up the whole house to find it, and you still might not. We have to build community. The relations we have with each other, which have been very fragmented by the kind of society that we live in, an individualistic, neoliberal, etc. society, those relations are going to be absolutely vital if there is some kind of partial collapse, as I'm suggesting there is very, very likely to be. The transition town movement is a good model here and has already achieved a certain amount. That needs to be built on, expanded. We need to work on how to preserve things which will be useful to future people through a potential collapse. For example, seed banks. Seed banks is a great example. Quite challenging, though, in the context of climatic change. The great seed bank at Svalbard, I don't know if many of you heard this worrying story, was seriously disturbed recently by the massive increase of temperatures in the Arctic. It was thought to be pretty much invulnerable. It's a seed bank basically in the ice, but it started melting. We have to think about how to preserve seeds through climatic change, and we also have to think about the kind of seeds which are going to be useful, basically being geographically distributed from where they originated, right, in relation to temperature rise and therefore changes of ranges of plants. For example, in this country, planting native species, of course, but we should also be planting some non-native species which will cope with higher temperatures, which are very likely to be coming our way. In Greenhouse, we call this kind of work, under my item four here, we call it transformational adaptation. We need to adapt to the climate change that is coming, and it needs to be, in ambition, it needs to be transformational. It needs to be mitigatory at the same time as it's adaptive, and it needs to be taken into account the serious changes that are likely to be coming.
That was part one of an hour-long program based on Rupert Reed's talk, This Civilization is Finished. So what is to be done? Come back when TUC Radio returns for more action items and part of the question and answer period. Rupert Reed was recorded at Churchill College, University of Cambridge, UK, on November 7, 2018. He is teaching philosophy at the University of East Anglia and is a longtime Green Party politician. His most recent book is This Civilization is Finished, Conversations on the End of Empire and What Lies Beyond. You can find the full video of the talk on YouTube. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. My name is Maria Gelerden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.